You are listening to WPVM LP 103.7 in Asheville, North Carolina, and globally at WPVMFM.org.
Here's your Radio Asheville weather report. Patchy fog developing early today across western North Carolina with temperatures around 68 degrees. Then partly sunny skies today with highs climbing into the upper 80s. A few showers and thunderstorms will be possible this afternoon and evening before temperatures settle around 70 tonight. Saturday looks mostly sunny to start out with a high near 90 before showers and thunderstorms move in during the afternoon and evening. I'm meteorologist Angie Kathleen on Radio Asheville 103.7.
Welcome to Twice 5 Miles Radio, fertile ground for conversations worth listening to and remembering. I'm your host, James Nave. Today, my guest is Kim Lane. Kim and I have known each other for over 30 years. We were both members of the Asheville Poetry Slam community, the spoken word community, active in Asheville in the early 90s. Kim was on the Asheville Poetry Slam team that won the national championships in Ann Arbor, Michigan in 1995. Kim went on to have a full career as a teacher, still doing it, still working in schools, still working with students. She also has a radio show called Pass the Hat, which she shares with a couple of other co-hosts. And so when I invited Kim on, I was thinking we would talk about poetry and the Poetry Slam. And in fact, I'm going to have her next week follow up with that conversation. This week, though, we started talking about radio and moved from radio into what it means to grow older, to age, what our responsibilities are around how we behave in respect to ourselves, as well as how we interact with other people. Kim loves to explore these things, and so do I, and we've talked many times over the years. Today is no different. So let's turn to the conversation I had with Kim, and she begins by talking about where she is in this conversation, in the moment of now. So I'll let Kim pick it up from here and tell you where she is and what she's up to, and you'll see what happens after that. So here you go.
I'm in the production room right now. Behind me, that is the banner for my radio show. It's called Pass the Hat, started by Kirk Ridge, local music icon, and Bob Johnson. So in 2018, they needed a substitute host. And I was known around here for hosting a lot of the musical events. My name came up, so they rang me up, and kind of the rest is history. And when the pandemic came, I became one of the three co-hosts, and it worked out really nicely. I've loved it.
How do you carry on with your show? When I do my show, I record on Zoom. I don't do it in the studio. I upload to KCEI Cultural Energy Radio in Taos and WPVM-FM Radio in Asheville. That's it. And I do it once a week. You are doing something different. How does it work for you? And how do you feel about your interactions with community radio?
Discovering community radio and being a part of it, becoming a contributor and a member of the community radio community has been one of the best things to ever happen. I love it so much. I work with really cool people with wildly diverse interests, from music and news and journalism and all of that, all these different histories. Our show and then our station has multiple sponsors. Our show has two sponsors. One of them, the sponsor for the first hour, is a local bakery that makes some pretty well-known crackers. They're flatbread crackers. The other one is a local chocolatier, Matthew, right across the street. And he makes just the most decadent, everything you can think of, the truffles, the, you know, the sheet chocolate. And so those are our show's two underwriters. We do our show live. During the pandemic, as so many people were, in addition to, you know, we do everything live from the board, and we have our guests live in studio We do not plug guitars or any electric equipment into the board. So you really are listening to a live concert. And the challenge is when you've got a band in here, you've got to manage it so it doesn't sound muddy because you're getting what's happening in the open air. Mostly we're successful with that. In addition to that, though, in the pandemic, we started live casting. So you can watch our show. If you tune in on Facebook or Twitch or YouTube, you can watch the show every night from 6:30 to 7:30 when our guest plays live. Then you can watch it forever on YouTube and for 2 weeks on Facebook and Twitch. We also archive the audio of our shows at whupfm.org. But it's still a very manageable production. Like, we can all do this. We have some little tools that we use. Bob Johnson developed most of how we do the live stream, and it works great.
Do you have it on any of the podcast platforms?
We haven't started podcasting yet, but that's interesting to me. And Bob is out of town for about a month, so I might be able to do something like that. Quality of our recordings are great because everything is coming through the board.
Podcasting, I found it to be about as easy as anything you can possibly do. I use a system called Transistor FM. Mm-hmm. It's not a video. It's just straight up audio. I upload it and it streams it out to every platform.
Very cool.
When you are doing the show live, do you follow a script or do you play the moment? How do you create those shows? And then how do you avoid, or do you even care about the stumbles, the uhs and the ahs and the flubs and the dubs and the thises and the thats? Do you have to deal with those at all in an editing, or do you just let it run live?
Well, we let it run live. The only thing we would have to be concerned about is, because we are a radio station and we have to honor FCC rules, so we can't say the seven dirty words, et cetera, and so on. And by and large, our guests also follow those rules. But if there were a slip, like they were to say a word they aren't supposed to say, we still wouldn't get in trouble for it because we didn't know it was coming. There's a certain element of you just kind of roll with it. As far as following a script, Kirk and Bob had, it wasn't a dyed-in-the-wool format, but they have a rhythm to their questioning. And Kirk is committed to a form of questioning. When we have a new to the show guest, someone who's never been on before, Kirk likes to know their backstory. When did you become a singer-songwriter? So he starts at the very beginning. What is your origin story? And we also break it down. What instrument did you play first? What brought you to music? And then how did that evolve into being a singer-songwriter? And that's usually the first 20 minutes to a half of a show. And then in the second half of the show, Kirk, we kind of lean on him to do that part of the questioning. And in the second part, our dynamic has naturally evolved to where I ask questions that are very different from show to show. And our guests have given us feedback that they really enjoy the way that we question them. They get to tell their origin story. And then what I do is I am a deep listener. So I am listening deeply to everything they play. I'm listening to the poetry of their songs. I'm watching their finger work. Usually it's guitar players. I'm watching their instrumentation. And I will ask them questions about, say, the metaphor I heard in a song. Did you mean to carry this conceit through the song? I'll ask about the origin of a song. Like, what brought that story to life? I may ask them about a song that is very poignant or painful or close. I may ask them if they had to get away from that situation before they could write about it. Because you and I are poets, and I don't know about you, but as a poet and singer-songwriter, I have to have distance from the pain points to write about them.
Deep listening. When you say deep listening, what do you mean?
I like listening to people. I love hearing people's stories a lot more, especially these days, than I enjoy telling my own. People have great stories to tell. I also love poetry and I love good instrumentation. I am in awe of most of the musicians who come through this studio. I love talking gear also. I'm a gear nerd. So you bring in a guitar, from, you know, way back when, or you bring in your new guitar, I want to talk about it. I want to hear the story of who gave that to you. Why did you buy that guitar? Did you buy that guitar because it complements your voice so well, or it serves as contrast? It's not just deep listening. It's also deep watching. I'm looking at this person get lost in the song. And that's where the questions come when they are sincere. I never have scripted questions. I also approach it kind of like, you know, I'm an educator. I work with middle school students as a gifted education specialist. I treat our guests like I treat our kids. I listen to the kids in the moment. I don't approach them with a formula, and it works.
Yeah, I'm interested in this because I have been listening to people for years on these shows. I think of myself as a, and this is going to sound a little funny, a shiny object listener.
Oh.
And what that means is somebody's like saying something, and suddenly yeah. I'm like the little kid. It's like, oh, yeah. Oh, what is that? You know, it's like when you said deep listening, I thought, well, I want to know more about what that means. What does deep yeah. listening mean? And to me, I don't think of myself, as I said, not necessarily as a deep listener, but I just wait around for something to sparkle. When it sparkles, I track it. Mm-hmm. And that to me is what deep listening is. And I imagine people who are listening to this show, they have different learning styles for what takes them more deeply into whatever the conversation is, or how to pay attention to the listening.
I have a question for you. Do you wear earbuds? I know you're wearing earbuds now so you can hear me, but in your life, when you take walks, when you're out and about in the world, do you wear earbuds or headphones?
I don't.
Okay, neither do I. And I think that's part of it. I'm a runner. A lot of people know that I'm a runner, swimmer, worker, outer. The only time that I wear earbuds in my life is at the gym. And the reason I wear them at the gym is because they often play the music so loud, and it's sort of thumpy, bass heavy music, that it interrupts the rhythm of my workout. So I'll wear earbuds there. But in my life, I fail to understand why people would want to wear earbuds all the time. As they're just walking around town, as they're walking around the store, as they're taking a walk through a state park, why are you wearing earbuds? If you are because it relaxes you or it helps you exercise better, peace go with you. But there is so much to hear in our world. I love overhearing little bits of conversation. I love hearing what's out there in the natural world. I have never found joy in wearing earphones in the world. You asked about my list, the learning style also. So when I hit the AARP age, you know, they offer you a free hearing test. Were you aware of that? Okay, yeah. So you didn't know that, you can get a free hearing test when you join AARP. You're welcome. So of course I did. And I went to the audiologist, got my hearing test, because I was starting to have a little bit of difficulty distinguishing the conversation I was having in a crowded room. And I thought, oh gosh, I hope I don't have hearing issues. It turns out I don't. What I learned from that hearing assessment, because it went longer than usual, the audiologist got my data back and he said, this is really interesting. He said, do you mind if I run some more tests on you? And I said, yeah, of course, because I want to make sure my ears are healthy. And went through and I start pressing all these buttons. He starts giving me all these memory tests. And I thought, oh God, here we go. You can't remember anything, Kim. And it turned out that my hearing is very good for someone of my age, because mostly I've taken care of it. But I also learned that I have an auditory processing disorder, which explains a challenge that I've had in my life, all of my life. And what I've done is I've masked it, as people of our generation did, because they didn't identify learning disabilities with us. An auditory processing disorder, the one I have, is such that I intake lots of information, but I am very slow to process it. For example, give me verbal directions to your house and watch me end up in Miami. And so what I've learned is I take a lot of physical notes. I have a lot of verbal habits where I'm actively engaged in listening, where I'll say, yeah, tell me more. Mm-hmm. It's just a processing thing to where my brain is super slow to process oral information. And so I found other ways to stay really actively engaged in my world. So I looked for visual cues and I look for other sensory cues so I can remember the things that I'm hearing and process them appropriately.
That's interesting. I'm thinking of myself. I do have these iPod earbuds and they have a sound blocking.
Yeah.
So I can block the sound. And I know some people who will wear the earbuds because they just cannot take all of the input. Yep. It overwhelms their thinking, their psychology. And so they'll block out a lot and they'll block it out with music. So when they're walking down the street or at the mall or in a crowded area, they have the earbuds in to block out all that stimulation so they can stay steady in their lives.
So a lot of that, I work with a lot of students who wear earphones at school for that.
Right.
They're blocking out noise. And that is often, not always, it's often a sign of neurodivergence. And this is another thing that we now understand for our younger generations, and we can support them. And I would be willing to bet, like you and I have the Poetry Slam community, because that's how you and I met. We know that if we really look at all the people that we've hung out with over the years, we know that the Poetry Slam community is chock full of people with various forms of neurodivergence. And that sensory overload is one of those forms. And I think we hung out with a lot of people. We might be people who did a lot of masking. I know as a gifted education specialist that giftedness is a form of neurodivergence. Extreme creativity, which you're a specialist in creativity, is a form of neurodivergence. So neurodivergence isn't always a diagnostic sort of state of being. It's simply a state of being in which the sensory world hits us different and we process it in ways that are at the edge of people's comfort, of people's way of thinking. And so we have to find tools to live in that world.
So what does neurodivergent actually mean? I think I know what it means. Two roads diverge in a yellow wood. So yeah. There's a split or something. Is that what it means? And neuro means brain, right?
It means that when you look at a normed state of being, as far as sensory sensitivity, whether it's visual, whether it's aural, or whether it's physical. So I work with a lot of kids who may have sensory overload and they have to wear a certain kind of clothing because they're overloaded by seams or buttons or zippers or something like that. If you're outside of a pretty wide norm of what our culture provides us, as far as noise, as far as the clothing that they wear, as far as the light sources that we see, then you may be a neurodivergent person as far as your sensory sensitivity. And then as far as creativity goes, we're finding other ways to measure that, for example. And so if you're out there on the edges of creativity, people give you a box, for example. They say, okay, make a picture using this box. Well, there are people like us who just like burn the box and we tear it apart and we build something else out of it. That's a form of neurodivergence.
So is everybody neurodivergent in their own way? Or who are the people in the non-neurodivergent tribe? How do I know if I belong, if I fit in that tribe, or if I've often thought that's the tribe I fit in. I'm fairly predictable. Yeah. I'm not that, I don't think I'm that neurodivergent. I mean, I flip letters around some.
Yeah.
I'm like if I'm presented with you know, the games of the genius games of who's buried in Grant's tomb. I never figure it out. I'm like minus seven on the scale or something. I can't put those games together. You know, the ice cube, the ice blocks in the center of the room, and somebody's hanging or whatever. And you have all these crazy questions. And I'm like, I have no idea. And I'm completely unable to figure that out.
Yeah.
Does that make me neurodivergent, or does that make me just rather in the middle? Or like with creativity, have come to believe creativity is this massive, abundant energy force that spins the earth, holds the gravity down, you know, brings us out of the womb, takes us into the grave. There's just so much of it that it overwhelms us. And when we talk about creativity, we're not talking about how much we have. We're talking about how we approach organizing the abundance. So it's not a conversation around creativity. It's really a conversation, almost mathematical conversation, around organization.
As someone who has access to every test in the world, you know, sort of academic measurable test, we have scales. We have a thing called the Gates scale that's a more subjective but measurable assessment. Like there are countless of these things. I do think that if you were to give every person the right test, you could find the areas in which you could measure, I would say, the areas in which they were neurodivergent. And as someone who, you know, I did my postgrad work in this at Duke. And so they give you all these tests and so I know the areas where I measure kind of hit the ceiling, if you will, you know, you can't go any further. I also know the areas in which I have deficit, for example, the aural, you know, the aural organization of information. I need supports in that. My daughter is an interesting example of, tests show that she's not neurodivergent, for example, and she has areas in which she is so strong, like mathematically, she's very strong scientifically. But when she was given her battery of gifted education tests, one area in which she needs support is with the, you know, you talk about the visual organization of shapes, for example, the paper folding test. My God, she still talks about that. She's like, that is the nightmare of my life. Ask me to put together something. And that's an area in which she needs significant support. So when my kid goes to college, for example, and she needs help building the IKEA furniture, she's going to call mommy because mommy's off the charts in that. And she is like, I don't know what to do with this. Where's the Allen wrench?
So I'm hearing you say we all have categories that we would fit in with this divergent thinking. Calling them are we calling them deficits? So in other words, I can't do this, so therefore I need help with this. So we all have our little weak spots, and conversely, strong spots. Do you ever run across somebody who just has massively strong spots in everything, or almost everything, or so it seems?
In a lot of things no, I don't. I'll tell you why. I work in particular with students who are what we call severely and profoundly gifted. And what that means is students who are working two grade levels beyond their age level peers. That is a severely and profoundly gifted student. When you have an 11-year-old who's reading at a college freshman level, that is a severely and profoundly gifted kid. And also this. Though many, many, many of those students, we talk about something called asynchronicity in giftedness. Asynchronicity is when, here, so my hands are in a straight line, when your intellectual capacity and performance are up here, but your social emotional performance and capacity it creates a gigantic gap. And the way that turns up in is things for many girls in particular, it can also show as extreme perfectionism and emotional dysregulation when you can't reach perfection. You've met these people. I think I used to be one of those people when I was a young girl, that when I couldn't reach a state of perfection, I got extremely frustrated and somewhat dysregulated. Like I didn't know how to deal with, I was never really shown how to fail. Failure is hard for gifted kids because school has been easy, easy, easy. They often hit middle school, something gets hard and they fall apart. And you and I both know, we know adults like this who never really got coached through failure. And it's nobody's fault. It's just a thing that we all have to learn how to deal with failure. We have to learn how to face the things that we're bad at. And that's the asynchronous gap. Sometimes it's making friends. You know, socially, people are, you know, look at some of our technology tycoons. Steve Jobs, like he was pretty open about this. These people socially were not the folks who were being asked out to all the parties. There's a reason for that, that they were neurodivergent in ways that made them socially not so fun to hang out with, but they solved problems really well.
Yeah. And I wonder about how we each fit into all those categories. And when somebody is dramatically brilliant and then they don't live up to it and they start failing in their desire for perfection, I wonder how they define perfection. And the reason I'm asking that is because perfection has never been achieved. It's the only thing that we have in our measures that is completely, utterly impossible to achieve. It will not happen. Now, you can get close and you can go towards excellence and you can declare it perfect.
Yeah.
But it's never going to happen. So I've always thought it was really a bit misinformed when people think, I want to be perfect, and you can't do it.
No. And I think that that's why grades can be really destructive to kids. When I talk about perfectionism, one of the things that drives that is grades and the search for straight A's. I happen to work in a really, really high octane school district. I don't want to name it, but it's a high octane school district. It's one of the most high performing in the state where I live. And because of that, we have these kids who, and their parents sometimes can fuel this, who if they don't have straight A's, they will make themselves physically sick to make the straight A's because that's the only measure they know. And it is my job, believe it or not, as a gifted ed specialist, so much of my work is not to support children in getting those straight A's, in getting better grades. It is in helping kids learn how to fail. In helping kids to understand that you are not your grades. Because I grew up believing that, and that was not anyone's fault. I did that to myself. I did not have pressure from my family to do that. I think they thought something was a little bit skewed with me, and it was. That was me.
Well, we all are in that category of success and failure. Yeah. I'm certainly not immune to it. I have it myself. Mm-hmm. I look back over my life and I think, oh man, you know, if I blew that, or God, why didn't I do this or that? And oh my goodness, look at me over there in that corner. Is there a better way to approach the language around that sort of build? Because it is a build. Yeah. When does failure cease to be failure, and when does it deserve a different kind of definition?
In today's world, in which we are constantly being subjected to people to compare ourselves to, it's just getting worse, isn't it? Like you open your phone. I don't have social media on my phone, and I've become less and less engaged with it over the years because between the AI slop, and it really is, it's just this thing where people just compare themselves to each other. You know, they've curated this presentation of their life. And I think that doesn't help for sure. The fact that you can open your phone and see this thing and compare yourself, if you're so moved to do that, to other people doing beautifully curated things. It's a good question to which I don't know the answer. What I know is that when I work with kids and when I mentor teachers, because I'm also a teacher mentor, is I don't encourage people to fail. Of course not. What I do encourage people to do is to be gentle on themselves, to be gracious, to be as gracious with themselves as they are with other people, that failure can be instructive, and to help them move through when failure is embarrassing or public. Like, that's hard. I help them move through that, but I also help them to identify that failure is not the end point. For example, as a teacher, I have always allowed my students to do retakes. That's one way I help them work through it, is that in life, just because you paid your bill late, for example, yeah, your power is going to get cut off, but they'll turn the power back on if you pay it on time. So I've always, from the very beginning, allowed my students to do retakes. I never allow them to write essays at home. I don't do homework. I supervise the writing process in the classroom so that I can guide them through. I want to see your introductory and concluding paragraphs. I'm now going to edit paragraph 2, and so on and so forth. So the kids have written the whole essay under my supervision in class so that they don't have homework. Their parents, who may not have any education at all, are not supervising an essay they don't know how to write. And if the kids failed, which they don't when you do it that way, but let's say they did, it's because you didn't come to school. So you can also mitigate the circumstances under which people fail. Like, we do set people up for failure in school. And I think part of my job is to set up better circumstances so I'm not just supervising a bunch of failure. We can do better.
And now that you're talking about it, I'm thinking about the things that I have labels failure and success. And if I start out in some sort of project, like I'm like, well, let's take this radio show that I do right now, the one we're on. This is a complete 100% utter success. This radio show. I get an A plus for my radio show. Now, good. I've only had 6 people send me an email in 10 years. Mm-hmm. Is that a success or failure? I have never made a dime on this radio show.
Right.
And I've not really ever tried to do it. Now, some people would say, oh my gosh, all that time and you haven't had any emails to speak of. I had one email from somebody who sort of a potential stalker. I was like, what is this? What's going on here? Nice. And how much fun, right? Let's laugh at that. And yet I feel like this is a complete success because I have framed it.
Yes.
Around what I want out of it. And what I want out of it are conversations. I want the people I talk to, like you, to teach me things I didn't know. I want to learn how to be more relaxed in my free flow thinking. Mm-hmm. And I get a kick out of having had conversations with 400 or 500 people.
Yeah.
Brilliant success. But measure my podcast against Ezra Klein.
Right.
Or the New York Times Daily with who knows how many millions of listeners, or Heather Cox Richardson. Heather yeah. Cox Richardson, who has 1 million a day, I'm yeah. a complete poor little rabbit in the woods.
Yep.
All wet from the rain and freezing to death. Failure completely. So it's about framing it, I think.
I think you've absolutely nailed it. There's a book I want to recommend to you that you will, I think, love it. If you haven't already read it, you probably already have. It is called Strength to Strength. And you'll forgive me if I forget the author's name. He's a former professor at Harvard, I think. And what this book is about is kind of this right here. It's about moving through your life, understanding when the peaks of your life come age-wise, and also there. So he divides up life into four quadrants, if you will, kind of like the Indian folks who believe in Hinduism. And he says that we spend too much time in the portion of our life, and I forget the Hindu name for it, in which we produce and create and seek, like the seekers and the buyers and the consumers. He said, what we need to do is to move more graciously toward the end part of your life, if you will, in which we become the sages. And in reading this book, I realized a few things. I realized, one, I think I'm doing life right, because I've always been a little bit resistant to consumer culture, to comparison culture. When I was very young, of course I did. I mean, I competed in poetry. Who does that? That's insane. But by and large, as I've become like a real adult, I have moved away from that. And here's what we need to be doing now, Jim. And that is, we need to be, according to this book, and I think according to just being human, you and I have reached a point in our lives where we need to start making the path easier for those to come behind us. So our job is not to produce more, to be more successful, or to get awards. We're now at the age where we're giving the awards. We're now at the age where we're setting up kids to get the awards. That, I think, is the success. If I leave when I retire in 4.5 years, if I leave a legacy of work that other people can do, and my name is not on it, but I left a legacy of work in which kids felt cared for, and that they can support people younger than them, and that they can do well in their lives and be safe and happy, that is a good legacy of work. That I didn't get an award for it, and I wasn't given any accolades, but that's our job as we get older, is to teach and be the sage and to get out of the way. And that may sound really grim to some people, but I think it's true.
Well, you're talking about the longevity movement that's out there, and you're offering a counterpoint to the longevity movement. The longevity focus, I want to live long, I want to be young. Many people will say, I am going to live to be 140 and I'm going to keep death at bay. I'm going to keep it at bay. This approach is less stressful because you can't keep death at bay. You might be able to avoid it for a little longer or whatever, but you can't keep it at bay.
No.
With this approach, it is prominent in the thinking.
Yeah.
And with that prominence allows the adjustment one needs in order to calibrate how one defines success.
Yep. And I think also, like, being a teacher has been instructive to me. Just overall, my career of being a teacher has been really instructive. And I'm grateful. I've been so grateful for my career. Could not have picked anything better to do, because it has shown, it has purpose. Every day is not always a happy day. I mean, I deal with middle school kids. Some days are absolutely miserable. But by and large, it has really set me up to accept these different phases of life. The older I get, true story, the younger these kids get. And I am not going to pretend, as cool as I think I am, I'm not, but as much as I read, as much as I try to keep up or embrace the newest technology, the older I get, the younger the kids get, and the harder it's going to be for me to relate to them. So I'm not going to break my neck trying to be cool or cute or Botox my face or fix my body to be relatable to these kids. Here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to model for them what healthy aging looks like and joyful aging. My hair is silver now. You knew me when I was, perhaps a little more cute redhead, but my hair is silver now, and that's on purpose. I have a daughter and student who are watching me, and I'm going to watch them. They're going to watch me age. I am not shooting things in on my face, but what I am doing is this. I lift really heavy, and I lift 5 days a week. I do appropriate cardio. I kayak, I hike. I have a really strong social network that is healthy and deep. I have love. That's what my kids see, is they see a lady who is absolutely getting older, but she's doing it with joy, and I'm transferring it back to these kids. And I acknowledge, I'm like, yeah, I'm an old lady and I don't know what you're talking about. So let's talk about it. Why don't you teach me something? And that feels pretty good.
Yeah, I've never given a lot of thought to aging with strategy. I'm not going to be able to avoid this. Yeah. So I might as well just lean into it. And I agree with you. I'm not, oh my gosh, I'm looking out the window and there's a little cub, a bear walking by about the size of the cutest thing, you know?
Are you in Taos right now? Or are you
in North Carolina at Lake Eden?
Well, they're migrating right now. So there was a bear over in Greensboro. One of my friends, they're crossing the state right now. And people are seeing bears all over the place. It's
yeah,
so
he's
funny.
Walking by just as casual as he could be.
That's hilarious.
So but he's young. So I should go out and I could mentor the bear. Say, excuse me, but I have some aged wisdom I would like to give you, you know, from my large perch up here on the second floor of this house. And the bear will just walk off into the woods as if I don't even exist. When people lean into the curiosities that they have, you're not going to prolong your life forever, but you can be curious. I'm as curious as I was when I was 15, maybe even a little bit more curious because I had more experience about how to track the curiosity.
Well, and what you're doing is one of the healthiest things you can do for your body and your brain, and that is to simply keep learning, which is what so many people fail to do. Like this year, one of the things I started to do, like we should start to do new things. It's never too late to learn new things. I started learning how to play piano this year. Am I good at it? No, of course not. Am I going to be good at it? Probably not. But it's hard. Playing guitar is one thing. I've done that for years and years. But playing piano, you are doing two very different things with each hand. You are playing chords and you're playing a melody, each with different hands. It is really like walking and chewing gum at the same time. And it has given me a lot of joy to do that. The other thing that I've committed to, and this has been going on for years, is I continue to study French. Like I continue to have conversations in French with some groups that I, friend groups you have online, by reading French books. I always need to engage with the big, hard, scary things. You know, kayaking, that's a big, hard, scary thing when you're doing it for 11 miles. I don't want to give those things up. I want to be age appropriate. I want to make sure I'm not hurting my body. Like I will say, I'm not marathoning anymore. A marathon is really, really hard on your body. And I can't do any more stress fractures, but I can hike a whole bunch of miles. I can still go up and climb Grandfather Mountain. So being within the appropriate boundaries, we should be doing the big, hard, scary things.
And I think learning how to do things like play the piano or a new language or a language that you want to keep up, I think that's really is significant because, and especially with language, it is constantly asking you to have a relationship with what you perceive as failure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And en français, quand je parle français avec toi comme ça, dans le radio comme ici, c'est bien pour moi à parler comme ça. But alors, je ne dis beaucoup de choses quand je parle français parce que je parle français comme l'Américain qui n'est pas français comme les personnes qui habitent à Paris.
Oui.
C'est oui. Difficile pour moi à parler français exactement et c'est très impossible pour moi à comprendre français dans la conversation à la table à Paris.
Non, d'accord. Je pense très lentement. Et c'est très difficile parce que je trop lentement. I'm slow. I'm thinking slow in French.
Oui.
I can understand your thing. Yeah. I can understand every word you're saying. And the difficulty and the exhaustion that comes in from people who in our own country are managing two different languages is that you're listening and probably understanding everything they're saying, and you're exhausting an enormous amount of energy trying to come up with what you're going to say back to them. That's exhausting.
Exactly. Yeah. And I've always had a difficult time. I can understand in a conversation maybe 30% of what's going on.
Yeah.
And if I'm listening to an advanced show about cops in French, I don't get all the slang.
Yeah.
But the point isn't whether you get it or not. The point for this whole conversation that we're having, you and I are having, and we've been having for many years, is that we show up and we do something. And I did throw out the French. And when I was doing it, the internal critic revved up because I knew I was flubbing it like crazy. And anybody who's listening to the show who speaks fluent French will think, God, Nave is out of his mind.
No, but that was understandable.
I mean,
and
you can get...
It's just as, you know, whatever, but
you
I
stumble
tried.
Through it. You stumble through yeah. it. But the yep. stumbling is where the joy lies.
Yeah.
Being able to futz around with it and care in a way that's meaningful rather than care in a way that's destructive.
Yeah. And it's interesting in a world in which so many things are I'm holding out my arm. I know people can't see me, but for the selfie, right? So many people are curating every action they take for the selfie or the selfie video. And that's something that, I don't know, I've not enjoyed that so much. I'm glad I was not raised with that. I'm glad that was not part of my young life because it still doesn't feel natural to me. I wish that people could just do things that are A, not on camera, and B, not monetized. The question I ask based on what you're saying is, who has hobbies anymore? You know, between the economy, people need more money. You know, people are hurting for money. People feel like they have to monetize every daggone thing they do because they're broke. And I also find that it seems like fewer and fewer people have just hobbies. Like playing piano, for example, playing guitar. Yeah, I've made a little bit of money as a singer-songwriter, but I've spent way more money on my guitars. I do a lot of things as hobbies, and I want to keep them as hobbies, at which I am fair to middling, and I just enjoy them because they're fun to do. Mm-hmm. But we live in a world in which everything is a competition, everything is monetized, everything is on camera, and I don't need everything I do to make money or to be seen. Which is a funny thing to say for those of us who competed the most ridiculous thing in the world, and that is competition poetry. But I think because I did that, because I competed in the most ridiculous competitive form in the whole wide world, I think that was instructive for me that I got that out of my system. Like something about doing poetry slam in the wonderful way that we did it. Like I have to say, we were really good at it. It got something out of my system. That need to compete. It really did. And aside from, you know, running a few marathons, which was really just for fun, I just wanted to know I could do it. I hate competing anymore. I do. I never play competition sports. I don't play competitive games that much. I just don't care.
Wow.
It's wild.
Well, that's an interesting point. And then I also have to slow down here for a moment and say that we have clocked out at 55 minutes right now, Kim.
Of course we have.
I think it would be wise if we do have a little bit of a closure here, but also put on the table that we can come back and do more of this because I have another 5 or 6 hours of imperfection to track with you.
Sweet.
But So as we say goodbye this time, hoping for more to come, tell us how to connect with you and just close it out so that I'll have something to give my listeners and a little hope that we'll have more of you later.
Well, I got to be honest with you. I don't really keep a public presence. I don't. Do they really want one? I'll tell you what. Why don't we invite people to come back for another conversation? And the reason I say that is because I really do try to keep my public persona on lockdown because I do work in a public school system. And as a result of that, I really do try to keep I try to keep my family safe. I try to keep my students safe. And as a result, I have to keep myself safe. So the public things I do are kind of in my community, but I don't have like a big public web presence. I hope that's okay.
That's okay. Okay. I would like for you to mention your radio show one more time and the community radio station that you're on, because we love this.
Yes, that I will do, because it's an US community project. If you go to whupfm.org and you click on that Listen Live button on Friday nights from 6 to 8 p.m., you will be listening to Whoop Ass the Hat. And if you're in the area in which we live, the footprint, you can go to 104.7 and you can listen to it on your FM radio. You can also go to Radio Garden, spin the globe. You can land in Central North Carolina and look for WHUPFM.org. And we have so much cool. It's not just Whoop Ass the Hat. We have so many cool shows. The show before us is one of my favorites of all time, and you would love it. It's called The Postmodern Cocktail Hour, and is hosted by Tony. It's a show of covers, and they are the most hilarious covers you've ever heard. You'll hear Tony Bennett doing a metal cover. Like, I don't know where Tony finds his stuff, but it is absolutely epic. Yeah, definitely listen to him.
Well, Kim Lane, thank you for this. I appreciate you
coming on there. It's been a heap of fun.
And there you go, my friends. Thus concludes my conversation with Kim Lane. I have invited her to come back next week. We're going to pick up our conversation and continue on. When she returns for the next episode, she and I are going to talk about her experiences when she was much younger, participating in the poetry community, the spoken word community, the slam community in Asheville in the early 90s. One of the things I'm attempting to do with this show, of course, have conversations with people. Sometimes I go solo and have a conversation with you just between the two of us and with no guest. I'm really interested in talking to people, getting the insights they have around the experiences they've processed throughout their lives. I am interested in a sense of the memoir idea, writing the memoir. I'm more interested, though, in not so much the narrative arc of a memoir that begins, has a good story, has lots of action, and then it concludes. I'm more interested from a journalistic point of view in finding out what it's like for somebody to experience something, what it's like to go somewhere and really drop into a community, or in this case, what it's like for Kim as she remembers her time in the poetry world. Now, the reason I'm doing that is because coming up in October, third weekend of October at Lake Eden, I'm working with Jennifer Pickering and some other collaborators on an event that will not be the Leaf Festival. It will be held on the grounds where the Leaf Festival was last year. This is going to be the Lake Eden reunion. It will have a lot of music. We'll have a lot of gatherings. I don't think we're going to have a big poetry slam like I did when I was hosting the Leaf Poetry Slams, but we are going to explore the poetics of things. And Kim will be on hand. She said, I'll bring my camping trailer. All you have to do is give me a spot to park, and I'll participate in any way possible. So Kim and I are going to explore with other poets ways to present spoken word, the language of spoken word on the stage, and how to explore it, a bit of a laboratory in the spirit of Black Mountain College. So Lake Eden reunion and book launch, I just finished with a book Jennifer Pickering and I put together called Live Life Like a Festival. And her collaborator as well, designer Lauren B. Hare, is also part of that. And so our names are on the front of the book. And so we're going to have a bit of a book launch, lots of romping around poetry and dance and music and all this other stuff. And Kim will be there. So next week, I'm going to get her to give us a little bit of a reflection on what it was like way back in the day and how all of that moves forward so easily into what's going on right now. All credits transfer. What you do yesterday will follow you into today and be there tomorrow, along with all the other experiences you collect in this momentous momentum that you're living, which is called life, of course. So I do hope you tune in again next week to see what Kim has to say. I'm really curious about it. I have a lot of questions I'd like to ask her around the whole sense of her take on the poetry world and how she participated in it. So with that, I will say thank you ever so much for listening to Twice 5 Miles Radio, fertile ground for conversations worth listening to and remembering. I am your host, James Nave. Thank you, Walter Parks, for our theme song, walterparks.com, for more on Walter's music. Daveen Dial, thank you for managing WPVM-FM in Asheville, and Robin Collier and Mike Tilley, thank you for doing the same with KCEI-FM Cultural Energy Radio in Taos. You can always reach me, Nave, at jamesnave.com. Nave is spelled N-A-V-E. I'd love to hear from you. And if you like to write and you would like to be part of our writing community, my creative collaborator, Allegra Houston, and I have a Zoom gathering every Saturday, noon to 1 p.m. Eastern time. And you can go to imaginativestorm.com and find the link for that. It's open. It's free. You can come and be part of it. We do occasionally ask for a little donation here and there just to help us along, but it's certainly optional. It's for anybody who wants to just be part of what we're doing. We'd love to have you. So with that, thanks again for tuning in. I do appreciate it, and I hope you come back sometime very, very soon. And until then, I'll catch you on that turnaround somewhere down the line.
The radio is an art form, you know. We don't want it to die, and I'm afraid that the people that buy all the radio stations might forget that this is not just a tool to make money. It's part of our society. It colors the way we act, the way we treat each other, you know. It's much bigger than a tool to make money. It's an art form. So, but what's great, what's ultimately the best about it, is it's fun and it's entertaining. And that's all we want to do is raise that question of, hey, how come we're not having as much fun as we did?